C1R.
Number 17B.
She goes on and says, it is not well to imagine that Jesus demonstrated the divine power to heal only, how she says, for a select number or for a limited period of time, since to all mankind and in every hour, divine love supplies all good. So this sentence is expanding the sentence that has been shown before, that therefore again showing that Jesus did not do it just for Lazarus or a few people at his time, that he did not just do it for himself at the point of resurrection, but really for all mankind, for mankind's reassurance, and showing that therefore these facts of being untouched by anything that may mar our identity, destroy our identity, deface our identity, that everything of that kind is not possible in neither in time nor in space. It is timeless, spaceless, and therefore a fact in being, an identity in being. Yes, if we consider what we have been reading here about Jesus resurrecting Lazarus up to this point, we perhaps can epitomize soul here. Mind can hold man forever intact and meet every human need, so that you get a sense that actually nothing can happen to us. See, we are under that constant fear, see, that something can happen to us. If I say we are under constant fear, that's a counterfeit of love, that something can happen to us, that we can lose something, that's a counterfeit of soul. And so that's the reason why she takes in here the love, because you remember how she said some paragraphs before that it is fear that causes disease. So love has to counteract that and say, look here, love too is soul. And that soul is intact, has identity, unchangeability. You will never lose anything. You will never gain nor lose anything. You are in a state of balance, of complete rest and balance, and therefore in that state everything will be right there, what you need. We come to the next paragraph. The miracle of grace is no miracle to love. And I begin to sense that here she picks up another subject. Suddenly she speaks about miracles, and that the miracles of grace is not a miracle to love. Well, she brings in love again, because before she had shown that actually love will always meet every human need, and to do that, love does that what appears to the human sense to be a miracle. So Jesus demonstrated the inability of corporeality as well as the infinite ability of spirit. So we begin to realize that she wants to bring out why a miracle is not a miracle. She has now to explain that, that there are no miracles, that what is called miracles just seems to be our belief that corporeality is unable to achieve something, the inability of corporeality, and it is a belief that spirit has not all possibilities and abilities. That's why we feel we see miracles when these beliefs are broken. But actually, they are no miracles. Therefore, Mrs. Eddy said, right away Jesus demonstrated. Now, we cannot demonstrate a miracle. We only can demonstrate a law. We only can demonstrate a principle. Therefore, we see always that what are called miracles and wonders are actually laws of a higher order. The moment something happens on a higher level than what we already know, we cannot explain what happens. So we call it miracle and say it is against the law, but it's only against the law within that narrow range where we have our understanding and knowledge of things. The moment we can expand our range and knowledge to a higher level, then we begin to learn higher laws and higher orders. And so on that level then, what is called miracle on a lower level are no more miracles. They are then demonstrations of a higher law. And that is what Jesus did. For his time it was inconceivable that one could heal spiritually, because at that time they only believed in the inability of corporeality, and they believed in the inability also of spirit. So when Jesus, from a higher standpoint, knowing the ability of spirit, was demonstrating the law of spirit, it appeared then to the people who did not know that law to be a miracle, to be a miracle of grace. To Jesus himself, it was a demonstration of a principle. So there are no miracles in the world. There are not even disorders in the world, because any kind of disorder to which we give the connotation disorder is actually only an order of a higher level which we do not yet see. But there is never any disorder in the world. If there would be disorder in the world, then God would have had to have the characteristics of being disordered. So whenever we meet miracles, whenever we meet disorder, both sides, we can be pretty sure that these are phenomena on a level, on a higher level, which we do not yet understand, but which on that higher level are only phenomena of laws. So, I stopped here in the middle of the sentence. I start again on line 15. Jesus demonstrated the inability of corporeality, that matter cannot heal, as well as the infinite ability of spirit, as we have seen that Christ could improve on a case, she had said, at the tone of spirit, thus helping erring human sense to flee from its own convictions, you see, to flee from its own narrow levels of understanding and seek safety in divine science. Therefore, in divine science, there we will find no miracles anymore, no disorder. So we get the sense that we have to bring everything back to science, and that within science we can demonstrate things according to law and order, and not as exceptions from laws. Reason, rightly directed, serves to correct the errors of corporeal sense. We have here again the corrective of science. But since sickness and death will seem real, again we have the seeming real, just we had it before under the tone of spirit, until, now we have it, until, to, at what point will they no more seem real? Until the science of man's eternal harmony breaks their illusions, their dreaming, with the unbroken reality of scientific being. So at this point, Mrs. Eddy wants to indicate that going through the first three stages, we have to arrive at the point where we see that love can only meet every human need, not as miracles, but on the basis of a science, of the science of being. And therefore, everything must be a demonstration from a scientific standpoint. Yes? So our epitome here is that the science of being demonstrates harmony by correcting the errors of corporeal sense. Again, this would be an answer. Show me how to heal. Here at the point of principle, show me how to heal. Well, go to the science of being. And there, in that science of being, we find really harmony, because a science can correct error, can heal sickness. Yes. Well, again, sometimes when one has done a page or so, or a few subtones, it's always good to say, now, what was the line of reasoning that I have been following? What are now the points? Can I remember now the points that I have been studying? So we go back and say, all right, she asked, tell me what sickness is, and tell me then how to heal it. So mind was saying, I am going to tell you what sickness is. Sickness is only a belief. Sickness is only mortal mind. And that mortal mind, through fear, can bring forth all kind of disease. So that's my explanation what disease is. Therefore, how to heal it? Well, instead of mortal mind, take the divine mind. That divine mind never fears, and that divine mind always delineates only images of harmony on the body. So you have gained the first step. You go to the second step of spirit and say, but if I see with my eyes that my body is swollen or that it has a disease and a boil and so on, I can see it. So she says, yes, that looks like that, but it's only a seeming. Matter itself cannot be diseased, because matter only does that what mortal mind has projected on matter. So we had that matter only suffers really in a belief, not in reality. And therefore, spirit can improve on that seeming belief and show the true reality. So we only have to refer back that the substance of being is actually spirit and not matter. So we would have established the fact, really, that mind is the healer, and that mind always acts and heals through spirit, not through matter. Then we have seen that Mrs. Eddy goes on and has given a sense of soul, and has said, look here, soul is that which keeps man forever intact. So I'm not going now to explain to you disease anymore at this point. I'm going to explain to you that you have never been diseased, that you have never got sick. Lazarus never died and lived in matter. He always was at the point of where his true identity is immortal. So also for us, we have to see that fundamentally the identity of our being has never been touched, has never become diseased, and now has to be healed. That divine love always gives to every situation what that situation needs, and so upholds the intactness of our true identity. That's soul. All right. Then she goes on to principle and says, you see, these healings that you see and that Jesus did, they are not miracles, they are not wonders. So she explains further how to heal and says, you know, don't think you have to work wonders, and that you have to go to a practitioner who does some tricks. Go to principle, go to science. There is a science about it, and that science demonstrates itself. And then all what you call miracles and wonders are nothing else but really the demonstration of divine laws. And so we begin to realize that we have to have another science than the material science and materia medica, and devote ourselves to that study of the science of, what does she call here, until the science of man's eternal harmony is seen. And that breaks the illusion. So I say, well, that's wonderful. So what is going to happen? So she goes to life and shows here which of these two theories concerning man are you ready to accept. So she's going to present two theories. At that point one would feel that it had, that has still to do with principle, because theories is the counterfeit of principle, theories is the counterfeit of science. But she presents the nature of those two theories through the tone of life. Namely, one theory is the mortal testimony, changing, dying, unreal. And the other is the eternal and real evidence, bearing truth signet, its lap piled high with immortal fruits. So you can hear at once that those two theories that she is going to present are two theories about the nature of being, life. The one is a mortal testimony, mortal, not an immortal testimony, which is changing, dying. And the other one is eternal, no more mortal, eternal, and real evidence, namely its lap piled high with immortal fruits. Can you hear the sense of fullness of life? The lap piled high, that's the fullness of life. So she says, you can choose. And that's what principle can do. The moment we go back and say, we have to rely on a principle and work things out from a principle, we always can choose between two principles. Either a wrong principle, which is always seeing everything as a state of lack, of decay, of dying, of fizzling out, or we can look out from the divine principle, and then we only see the fullness of life. Because from the divine principle, principle is always expressing itself and is understood through its ideas. Therefore, from that point of view, we really can project and into our universe and on ourselves too, the immortality of idea, immortal ideas, all the ideas, the fullness of ideas, the multiplication of ideas, and it multiplies and multiplies until we feel that we live and move in a realm of abundance. That abundance naturally is flooding the patient and is giving him new life, the fullness of life. So we have epitomized here by saying, by accepting the eternal evidence of reality, we have the fullness of immortal fruit. These are our demonstrations. This is our healing, the immortal fruits. So it's always up to us which standpoint we want to take, which of those two theories we want to accept. Do we want to accept the principle of lack, or do we want to accept the principle of fullness? We go on to the next. Our master cast out devils, evils. The moment you have cast out, somehow it rings a bell. This is truth. Truth is that casts out, that destroys, that annihilates. So our master cast out devils and healed the sick. This is typically truth. It should be said of his followers also, not only of Jesus, that they cast fear and all evil out of themselves and others and heal the sick. It's so interesting to see here how here she gives, so to say, the method of healing, that she says, not only Jesus naturally should cast it out, you yourself should cast out, but how? And she gives two steps, so to say, namely, cast fear and all evil out of themselves, first, and others, and heal the sick. A practitioner cannot heal if he does not try more and more to cast out evil out of himself first, or he has nothing from which he can draw his spiritual power. Therefore, a practitioner has always a big patient, that's he himself. He must work on him himself. That's the first requirement, so to say, that he is honest with himself and says, well, how far do I express really the truth? And is investigating himself. He's not going to put the blame on other people. He says, I have a consciousness of my own. I can mold my consciousness according to the divine principle. The divine principle has life. It has the fullness of idea. I can give to myself the fullness of idea. And by healing myself, I can heal the others. So God will heal the sick through man. In that case, see, he heals through man. So to say, man here, or the practitioner, is the mediator between God and man. So whenever man is governed by God, so again, truth casts out error now as surely as it did 19 centuries ago, again reinforcing that she says, Jesus cast it out, his followers should cast it out, we today should cast it out, we do the same. Then perhaps she has to answer a suggestion that the reader will bring forth, that he says, yes, but somehow I don't understand the truth well enough to really manage it, to really make a demonstration. So she said, yes, all of truth is not understood yet. Hence, his healing power is not fully demonstrated. But we remember that in the 13th chapter she brought out in various ways that the little seed can do wonders for us, and that we should really use that little seed, that little bit which we already have, and not say, I have not yet enough understanding to work out this or that problem. We always should really make use of the little we have. Instruct the wise man, and he will yet be wiser. Then it goes on, still in the tone of truth, and we see it in the side note, destruction of all evil. If sickness is true, or the idea of truth, you cannot destroy sickness. And it would be absurd to try. So here she just answers, so to say, the critics. Actually, she doesn't give new information. She just shows, well, if sickness should not be cast out, then actually it would be wrong to try to heal ourselves. Then we should be happy to be sick and go on being sick. Then classifies sickness and error, as our master did when he spoke of the sick whom Satan has bound. You remember earlier in the chapter she said classifies sickness as error. Now, at this point, she has another angle on it. She says, classify disease and error into a classification, namely, as that which Satan has bound. And find a sovereign antidote for error in the life-giving power of truth acting on human belief. Can you hear? Now she comes to the tone of truth. She says, this is the life-giving power of truth acting on human belief, a power which does what? Which opens the prison doors to such as are bound because Satan hath bound them, she hath said before, so they are bound, though we open the prison doors of such they are bound, and set the captive free physically and morally. And you have a great sense here of truth, setting men free. Our epitome here reads, sickness is error, and truth casts it out, setting the captive free. So will you explain sickness? Yes, sickness is that when we are bound by Satan. Satan, the Antichrist, the opposite of truth. So with truth, you set the captive free. We free ourselves through our consciousness. Because from the point of view of principle, we know that we can project all the ideas of life on us and the universe, the fullness of life. Therefore, with that fullness of life, which is the truth about the situation, we really can destroy the lack of a situation. And finally, we come to the last paragraph of love, which is a rather involved statement, because here in love she just enumerates all the goody-goodies that we can have in metaphysics. When the illusions of sickness or sin tempts you, now it's a tempting of it. We know that love is that which frees us from temptation, tempts you. What are you going to do then? And you get the tone of love. Cling steadfastly to God and His idea. To God and His idea. Isn't that terrific? See, now again, as we had before, she lifts up the whole thought to the level of idea, which is absolute. Allow nothing but His likeness to abide in your thought. Let neither fear nor doubt overshadow your clear sense and calm trust that the recognition of life harmonious as life eternally is can destroy any painful sense of or belief in that which life is not. Again, a terrific sense. Just if it tempts you, hold fast to God and its idea. What do you hold fast? First, let nothing enter you which is not in line with God and His idea. What is in line with God's idea is that which life is. Let Christian Science, instead of corporeal sense, support your understanding of being. And this understanding will supplant error with truth. Again, you have life, truth, love. You see, she reiterates life, truth, and love always in this paragraph to bring out the climax. So, and this understanding will supplant error with truth. Again, tone of truth. Replace mortality with immortality. You really begin now to sense a taste of heaven. And silence discord with harmony. So whenever she speaks about that trinity of immortality and harmony, it is a sense of heaven, which is the day of rest in love. So our epitome here finally is clinging steadfastly to God and His ideas, silences discord with harmony. It is finished. Will you explain me sickness and how it's to be healed? Here we have a short description of the seventh. All right, I make here a break.